My name is Katie Stone, and I am representing SSDP as our alumni coordinator. And I've also got our
chair for
and she's going to be joining us for this interview. And yeah, so we'll start off with just a brief introduction, a brief synopsis, a few sentences, if you can, of your life's work to this point, just to introduce our listeners who don't know who you are.
Okay, I'm Jim Fadiman, and I have been working with psychedelics in one way or another for over 40 years. Did my dissertation about their effectiveness as therapy from Stanford, and then when the government stopped all research, did other things. And now I am researching and writing and speaking about the current situation, which is quite favorable and very exciting.
Perfectly said. So one thing that we definitely wanted to touch on is your most well-known work, which would be the Psychedelic Explorer's Guide. And we would like to share with our listeners a little bit about how you got to that moment where you decided it was time to write that. If there was a certain watershed event where it made sense that it was time, or if it had been kind of calling on you for a long time, what was the process behind the publication of that book?
Well, it's not quite so honorable and appropriate, but science is really, as you know, a lot shabbier than it, in the making than it is in the publishing. So I was going to do a total vanity press of a memoir of what an amazing, interesting person I was and how many wonderful, interesting people I'd either met or done something with. And I finally realized after working on that for a while that nobody cared about that very much. And then I asked myself, however, about psychedelic work, was there anything that I knew that other people were either forgetting or didn't know? And then I realized there was quite a lot. And so I began to write this book to preserve, really, to save the work that we had done in the 60s and later that other people didn't know about, which included, for instance, using psychedelics for hard-nosed scientific problem-solving, which works and is very exciting. And I'm sorry Steve Jobs isn't here to say, "You're right, man." But an awful lot of people in Silicon Valley do have used psychedelics for scientific breakthroughs. So that's one of the areas that's in the book, for example, that really isn't anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And it's been a great pleasure because I get feedback from people saying, "I'd like to replicate this," or "Have you heard about this?" So it's as if I've also created a small community of people who have shared my interest, and that's very exciting.
Absolutely. And then another thing we wanted to hear a little bit more about is what prompted you to get involved with psychedelic research in the first place?
Well, I was an undergraduate at Harvard, and I had a very neurotic, very gifted teacher named Richard Alpert, and he and I actually became friends. I came out to Stanford with him on my junior summer. I was a research assistant for some conventional projects, but we got to be really close. And then after college was over, I went to Europe intending to last as long as I could over there, on living in as little as possible. And some months later, Richard Alpert appeared in Paris, and he said to me, "The most wonderful thing in the world has happened to me, and I want to share it with you." Now, this is your, you know, my revered teacher. So I said, "Okay." And then he reached in his jacket pocket and took out a little bottle of pills. And I thought, "Oh, words you can't say on radio. What is going on?" And I had that much knowledge of psychedelics, which was zero. But so did everybody else.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I took psilocybin that night. And I'm sitting in the cafe with Dick. And the colors are getting very bright. And everything is looking quite amazing, a little too much. And the people in back of me, I can hear their conversations much more easily. In fact, I think to myself, my French isn't that good. I can't normally hear their conversations at all. So we retreated to my fifth floor walk-up, and I discovered that there was actually other levels to the world that I had no idea about. Now, this was not a transcendental experience. This was not a mystical experience. But it was sure letting go of a lot of attachments, such as without my books, I am nobody, which Harvard students tend to get into.
I can imagine.
And then some really weeks later, I came back to the States, and I was eventually ended up with a group in Menlo Park who were doing high-dose LSD research. And they took me in because I'd had this little bits of psilocybin experience. And then they said to me, maybe you'd like to take it with us. So I had a high-dose LSD experience, and that transformed my life because that was transcendental. That was past what the Buddhists call the world of 10,000 things. And it also was past my identity, mm-hmm. so that Jim Fadiman became a subset of who I am. And that has given me a great deal of freedom because Jim Fadiman does all kinds of things that I wouldn't do.
Absolutely.
But we get along together quite well. And so my work has continued from that place. And I have never, shall we say, recovered from the insights I got, which were similar, as I later learned, to the revelations behind most of the great spiritual traditions. Mm-hmm. So it turns out I was part of an extremely old and extremely sophisticated family of people who had had these experiences, some with psychedelics, some in other ways.
That's beautiful. And I've heard that story before, but I'd never noticed the fact that you were given pills when you were in France versus an actual plant. Can you speak a little bit about that, if there was a difference in your experience, or if you noticed a difference? Or...
Well, the difference between psilocybin, the chemical, and psilocybin from the mushroom, according to Albert Hofmann, who synthesized psilocybin, mm-hmm. He said the difference between the synthetic and the actual is a matter of personal opinion, nothing more. Mm-hmm. So that was his opinion. Mushrooms have become more and more popular for the obvious reason that mushrooms have never understood that they've been legislated against. So they continue to be available. And what psilocybin, it turns out there's about 200 species. Mm-hmm. Not all of them contain enough psilocybin to matter, but it seems to be a very popular mushroom. And it also, curiously, follows people around. So it's found at the edge of human habitation, mm-hmm. and of course it's found in cow pies. Mm-hmm. Which are, you know, we have created the animals that support the mushroom. Mm-hmm. And so it's a question of whether the mushroom has been following us or we've been following the mushroom. But in terms of synthetic, most people these days do not have access to psilocybin. Mm-hmm. It's a hard synthesis. And the people I'm working with around the world, almost all of them, who don't have access to LSD are using mushrooms for their own work.
And have you ever heard of a situation where anyone's had a transcendental experience similar to the very high dose that you had when you were under the LSD influence, but if they've had that very intense transcendental experience with manufactured, synthesized psilocybin, has that occurred?
Oh, certainly.
Okay. So yeah. That was one question we were very curious about, is the concept of plants having some sort of consciousness and whether that will translate differently within a hallucinogenic experience.
Well, that's the curious thing, is LSD doesn't have a plant.
Right.
There are plants that contain something called LSA, mm-hmm. which is lysergic acid amide, which is a hundredth as strong, mm-hmm. but that works out if, say, looks at a morning glory seed, mm-hmm. certain species of morning glory seeds have that, and it works out to approximately the equivalent of, say, a microgram per seed. So if one was dosing with seeds, which if you go online, there's lots and lots of ways to make that palatable, mm-hmm. Because the rest of it is wood. but there are plant equivalents. But when you work with certain plants, they appear to have a consciousness. Mm-hmm. Most strong is ayahuasca. Mm-hmm. So people regularly will talk about Mother Ayahuasca, mm-hmm. And that ayahuasca speaks directly to them, mm-hmm. with things like...
For our listeners, that's Jimmy. He completely
I have my small dog does not understand some of our conversations, but he is very aware that my wife has left and he is sorry about that.
So yes, we were speaking about ayahuasca.
And ayahuasca, speaks directly to people in English and says things like, stop doing that kind of yoga, it's not good for you. And I literally have a friend whose first ayahuasca experience, he was a yoga teacher. And they had a little argument. And afterwards, whenever he would do yoga, he'd get sick.
So. I've heard of similar experiences with actually having a physiological reaction once you would engage in that activity again after that experience.
Yeah, so that he was told for some reason he shouldn't do it. And,
that's interesting.
No one has ever talked about Mama LSD.
Right, yeah.
And the way I look at it is, and it's clear particularly with ayahuasca, is the plants have an agenda. Mm-hmm. And their agenda is similar to ours, which is they would like the earth to be saved, especially for plants. And the synthetics just don't have that agenda. So in a sense, LSD can be focused much more easily because you're really dealing with its capacity to assist your brain. Mm-hmm. While ayahuasca and San Pedro, which is also a mescaline peyote, have their own point of view.
Gotcha.
And one of the ways that you... one of my favorite peyote stories is a gringo has been accepted by the huichol, and they're on their annual peyote quest. And everyone searches for peyote after you've had a prayer meeting in an evening, and other people are finding peyote, and he's not finding any, and he's feeling like terrible, and all the work he's done, and all the integration he's done, and all the being good with the huichol, nothing. And he finally kind of has a I give up prayer. And then he looks up and the peyote's like little lights.
Oh, wow.
You know, literally where you can imagine little teeny searchlights, you know, about the size of a quarter. And so he walks around and picks those peyotes who clearly now say, you may pick me.
Wow.
So that's the kind of thing that suggests there's something more going on than a bunch of alkaloids sitting in a little plant.
Right.
Some of which affect human consciousness. And the other question, of course, is why are these alkaloids in all these plants that predominantly affect human beings? Mm-hmm. They are used in other ways, and some animals use them. But they also have one thing in common, which is the two most terrible tastes one can ever have in one's life is ayahuasca and peyote.
Mm-hmm.
And an anthropologist said very clearly, he said, maybe that's to protect people.
Oh.
Who shouldn't be using them. You have to really want to have
yes.
that experience and to overcome your revulsion. And so the plant is saying, you're not going to pick me by mistake.
Right.
You know, I'm not a plum.
And that kind of gets into my next question about, as we move forward with drug reform and drug policy like legalization and all these things that are happening right now on a national and local California stage, how do you think that difference between the two is going to play out?
Well, the thing about marijuana is there are 140 million people in the United States who've had marijuana. Nobody's died. Okay? Now, it's hard to find another substance you can say that. You can't say that about peanuts. Jack's my favorite poster. I think it's probably you guys have done it. It's you know, causes of death, and the top is like tobacco, 400,000, mm-hmm. alcohol, 200,000. You go way down to 100. And that's peanuts. And then you go to marijuana, zero. And I just love that poster because it makes the point that whatever else you can say about marijuana, it's hard to get in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we've managed with edibles where you have a concentration mm-hmm. and people don't quite know how to dose.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an incredibly safe substance.
Mm-hmm.
And it has a vast amount of medical uses. And it's had 140 million people that said, whatever the government tells me that's bad about this is not true. And it's working beautifully. I mean, Colorado, you know, crime is down and auto deaths are down and teenage use is down.
Mm-hmm.
It's everything that us ultra, you know, left-wing liberals said would happen.
Mm-hmm.
Psychedelics are different because they actually take a lot of care.
Mm-hmm.
The parallel that I've been making, and I've just been working with Amanda Fielding in England on a how can we come at legislation? And the legislation comes at two levels. One is, I think it is inappropriate for any culture, for its own sake, to legislate against anything that can bring you closer to divinity. it is inappropriate for any culture to prevent an individual from safely investigating his or her own consciousness and self-healing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's inappropriate for any culture to prevent people using scientific tools to discover more about the known and unknown universe. So that's kind of my basis, and what's nice about that is even if I'm talking with very right-wing people who are totally against everything else we're going to talk about, they say, yeah, I guess you're right about those.
I get what you're saying, yeah.
And then the question of use, and what I'm looking at is parallel to a driver's license. It is a right of every citizen to drive a car if they know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And there's simply examinations that say, do you know what you're doing? And we know that early drivers make more mistakes than other drivers
mm-hmm.
because they lack experience, mm-hmm. but they all have a knowledge base.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, I think that would make a way of doing it differently than marijuana, which is if you know what you're doing, then that's fine. It's a little bit like sex education.
Absolutely.
The notion of sex education is the chances are you're going to do it.
Yeah.
So why don't we give you information which at the time will be very useful? And so imagine that one has, in a sense, a series of licenses, which is a bit like an automobile or an airplane, which is you have, in California, you have what is called a Class C license, whatever that
it doesn't mean stand
for car, unfortunately. But there are other licenses for, say, driving a truck, which you have to know more and be more sophisticated.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to drive a bus, that's mm-hmm. another license, even more sophisticated. And if you want to drive what's called dangerous cargoes, which would be toxic chemicals, flammables, radioactives.
Mm-hmm.
You have to, it's a super license.
Gotcha.
So imagine having a series of licenses where you can use it yourself, you can use it socially, you can give it to someone up to a certain level, and you can be a guide or a therapist. That to me makes a lot of sense, and it meets the needs of the culture to prevent harm.
And I think in a lot of ways it also mimics traditional cultures.
Yeah, it doesn't, right, it isn't setting a whole nother process.
Mm-hmm.
And in a sense, the way Colorado and now I think Massachusetts said, treat it like alcohol. That was the simile, you know, treat marijuana like alcohol, which means license it, distribute it, not everywhere, not by anybody, and tax the hell out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody said, terrific. Please let me pay taxes.
So do you think a similar model may someday work for psychedelics, like a taxation? And
well, taxation isn't going to be much of an issue because unlike marijuana, you use very little and you use it not very often.
Mm-hmm.
So it's I think the taxation issue is very minimal because this is not going to be a high profit item.
Mm-hmm.
However, particularly if people can grow their own.
Absolutely.
And growing marijuana, it turns out, is a lot trickier than people thought.
Yeah.
But growing peyote cactus, even though it'll take you about 8 years, isn't hard. And mushrooms are, you can now buy kits, because
mm-hmm.
I have people who write me and say, I'll be starting my study with you in 3 weeks, because my kit is in the refrigerator, and I will harvest in 3 weeks.
So you mentioned your study. Can you go a little bit more into that, what you're working on right now?
Well, what I'm working on, since I'm not affiliated with a hospital or a university, and I'm certainly not an MD, I got interested in microdosing. And microdosing is tiny, tiny little doses. Let me just give you numbers, because a lot of the people who are listening to this do understand LSD, which is 400 micrograms is a very high dose of psychedelics. That's a transcendental dose. 200 micrograms is a therapeutic dose because you still have your identity and you can look at your issues. 100 is for very good science problem solving. 50 used to be called a museum dose. It's now called a concert dose.
Wonderful.
And 10 micrograms is a microdose. Now, at 10 micrograms, you don't have any visual excitement. The rocks don't glitter even a little. and the flowers do not turn as you go by. But what you do have is what seems to be basically your system works better. Someone called it enhanced well-being in a variety of areas. And Albert Hofmann, again, the person who synthesized LSD, said this was the unresearched area. And he personally microdosed for the last 20 years of his life. And certainly not every day. He said usually when he's walking in trees. Because he was a very great believer in taking psychedelics in nature. Mm-hmm. So I got interested. A friend of mine had told me that Albert had said to him, why don't you try microdosing because you're having some emotional issues with your girlfriend? And so the two of them were microdosing, and she said, I want to stop because it's bringing up feelings that I don't want to feel. And he continued, and their relationship did not last. But I became very interested and started to explore what was this area of psychedelics that had no mystical overtones, no cultural upset, and seemed to be something you added to your day as you would a cup of coffee.
Interesting.
And from that, what I've found is that microdosing is extraordinarily helpful in having you function better. Now, that means less pain if you're in pain. With many, many, many people, it alleviates depression. And lowers anxiety. I have some wonderful, one social anxiety story. This is an undergraduate somewhere, because when people write me, I not only don't know how to know where they come from, but I usually get rid of their name after I've gotten the email.
Absolutely.
And she said, I was checking if it would help social anxiety. So she took a microdose of psilocybin and went to Walmart in the evening. And she said, normally, she would keep her head down, she wouldn't talk to anybody, and it would take her forever to make any decisions. She said, I had my head up, I made eye contact, I made my decisions, and I had a nice time.
That's amazing.
Then another person with social anxiety said that sitting alone in a restaurant or in a coffee shop was really hard. And she said, the other day I went to a coffee shop in Santa Cruz, and I started talking to other people, and I had a lovely time. So social anxiety. Worked with one man with Parkinson's.
Oh.
And after a month of taking it every fourth day, and his taking elaborate notes because he had written some books before he'd gotten Parkinson's, so he was very literate, very wordy. It did not help his Parkinson's symptoms, but it helped his underlying depression. Because if you have Parkinson's, it's depressing.
Yeah.
So those are the kinds of studies I'm doing, and people basically write me and say, would you like to hear my story, or can you tell me how to safely use microdoses? And I'm just collecting this information, and it is what my research is now. So that's what
that's
I'm
fantastic.
Doing.
So, I mean, going forward with that research, do you see yourself, once things have changed legally and there's not so much, gray area, would you ever consider working with a university again, or trying to help facilitate some sort of institution housed within a public university?
Well, the nice thing about a university is it's set up to do this kind of research quite easily.
Mm-hmm.
If we just change it again, say, to coffee or grass-fed beef or anything, then it's really easy for a university to say, well, we're going to give it to so many people, and they're going to take notes, and we're going to ask them every day, or they're going to come into the lab and we'll do blood work. So it's really set up. What I think will happen, and I'm already seeing it, is people are starting to do studies of using microdosing. Because I have now three groups
mm-hmm.
who've written me and said, a number of us would like to microdose. What kind of data would you like us to collect? And so I get mail now and then saying, we're in our fifth cycle of 4 days, and here's the questions that have come up. And so I'm getting, in a sense, several studies run at once, not all in this country, where people are basically pooling their experiences. So we're really trying to find out what's going on. And physiologically, it's always tempting to say, well, what's going on in their brains and bloodstream, and the answer with microdoses is awfully little, okay, and awfully hard to measure. So if your whole system is running better, that say your immune system is improved or your inflammation is down, everything improves. Mm-hmm. So what do you measure? The answer is, one of the things you can measure is people's subjective feeling.
Absolutely.
So that's really what I'm doing, is finding out from people what it feels like for them to be using a microdose, and they're picking the substance. And people have written me a lot about with mushrooms, number with LSD. A couple of people in England, there's a substance called 1P-LSD, which will be illegal in England by January, I'm told. But it seems to be similar to LSD, slightly different dose level. Some people have used ibogaine and ayahuasca. So I'm really finding out what happens at this very low level. And the answer is, so far, almost no negatives. And most people say this was very positive, and I would not continue to use it at the every 4 day level. I would use it now and then when it feels appropriate. So I got a letter from someone that said, I flunked my driving test twice. I took a microdose the third time and did fine. Now, that's a combination probably of lowering anxiety, kind of being able to be calm, and probably a very small improvement in physical and visual acuity.
Absolutely.
So it's a wonderful area of study because nobody gets hurt and nobody gets excited. And people not only report personal improvement, but they say, my spouse or my kids like it.
Yes, because they're experiencing.
So I had a report from someone in China, and he wrote that on his third day, now this particular odd part about using microdoses, there seems to be a two-day effect. That in itself is a fascinating discovery. So I ask people to take it every fourth day because I want them to not have it, both because so they can see the difference and also so their system can take it again. Mm-hmm. And he wrote, he noticed that on third days, people would say to him, you're not as nice today. Is everything all right?
How
so that's the kind of independent agreement that's really exciting.
My gosh. I'm just thinking of the implications that this is going to have in the coming years. I mean, we're hoping for psychedelics, or at least psilocybin, to be legalized for therapeutic use and research by 2021, I think is our...
That's the Hefner Foundation kind of timeline. And the tricky part in the American medical system is it takes an unbelievable amount of effort to get it approved for a tiny little use. Mm-hmm. However, the kind of funny little secret is once it's approved for a use, then any physician can use it for anything,
right?
Called off-label. So just as there's a number of states now which are making CBD or high marijuana,
absolutely,
high CBD marijuana legal for a few little illnesses.
Mm-hmm.
But your physician probably can say, well, you know, you don't have this illness, but you could try this.
So what about in the situation, though, where it's not a matter of an illness or a medical need, but more of a personal exploration?
Well, as a country, we've always had two major waves. One is the Puritans, that if you're having a good time, there's something bad. And you should wait till heaven to have a good time.
Yes.
The other is, this is a really lovely place here, and we should enjoy ourselves because we're probably all going to leave at some point. And those two waves, you can really look at the history of America as the battle between those two forces. And psychedelics clearly is on the side of immediate awareness of that the world is a beautiful place. Mm-hmm. And the other side is, no, it isn't, and if you're aware that the world is a beautiful place, you're in delusion. And get back to work. And so it's in a sense, that's an invisible argument.
Hmm.
But there was an editorial in the Stanford newspaper a year or two ago when I knew the world was changing. And when you read a newspaper, there's the little subheads, you know, where the type is like 36 point. And it was, it is not a moral crime to want to get high.
Wow, what a statement.
And that's a real shift. And see, when you say that and you think, No, it's not.
Right.
But then you realize, wait a moment, I've grown up in a culture which says it is a moral crime to be high. It is, now, again, alcoholism was not considered a disease, it was considered moral degeneracy. Mm-hmm. Because clearly you could not drink because you could not give yourself the pleasure of drinking because that's a moral choice. So we're moving away from that moral high, you know, kind of, it's not a very high ground, that's the wrong word indeed, that moral swamp that says there is something inherently wrong about enhanced experience. Mm-hmm. And that's where the laws aren't changing. The country is changing. And what I find is so far, the people, particularly the students, are way, way, way ahead of the regulators, and the regulators are way, way ahead of the legislators. And if you wanted a group that has the least psychedelic experience of any group in the country, it's legislators.
Go figure.
And just as a number to throw out, because I threw out 140 million, since LSD became illegal, now I'm not talking about mushrooms, I'm not talking about MDA, just not everything else, just LSD, 26 million Americans have had LSD. And that figure, which goes up 400,000 to 600,000 a year, seems to be absolutely independent of whether things are going well or badly in research, whether anyone cares, whether there's scare stories. It just keeps going.
Interesting.
So each year, 400,000 to 600,000 people find out that the psychedelic experience they had, on the whole, was beneficial.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what's also happening is we're changing a vocabulary. The vocabulary used to be, well, that was just a bad trip, meaning some horrible paranoid hell that you're in for 4 or 5 hours. But now if we change it, and the word is challenging trip. And I was talking with a group of about 400 Santa Cruz students, and I said, how many of you have had a bad trip? And 85%. And I said, how many of you feel it was a beneficial trip? Almost all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then John Hopkins actually did a survey online that said, tell us about your worst trip. And then one of their questions was, how valuable was it?
Mm-hmm.
And the value of the worst trip was very similar to another survey they'd done on best trips in terms of value and importance.
Mm-hmm.
So that people felt their worst trips were almost as valuable as their, quote, best trips. So we're really needing to rethink the whole question of what goes on in consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And the tide in the country is clearly toward what I talked about before of not preventing people from self-exploration.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're the me generation. If you go into a bookstore and you look at the psychology shelves, there's some. But if you go to the self-help shelves, they're vastly more. So we're a country that says it's okay to work on yourself.
That's true.
And it's okay to use unbelievably odd tools if you read those books.
That's true.
And I've written one, so I'm aware of the kind of embarrassing things that are out there. But psychedelics are simply one of those tools, and as people learn to use them safely and well, which is not that hard to do, we'll see more of it. So probably, again, the licensing regulation is going to be tricky, and we'll probably do it state by state, and some states will make odd laws that work, and others will make terrifically sensible laws that don't, and so forth. But that is one of the great advantages of our system.
So it's very tricky, but at the same time, and I'm not sure if this resonates with you at all or not, but coming from my own background in ego psychology, I feel a very intense sense of urgency to carry this legislation forward as fast as possible in hopes of perhaps mitigating some of the very damaging effects of our current culture and society.
Well, we go back to the plants for a moment. You know, one of the questions is, ayahuasca has been minding its own business in the Amazon for hundreds, maybe thousands of years. And ayahuasca, just so people know, is two plants that are kind of cooked together. And one assists the other.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, ayahuasca is everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Big in Northern California. It's also big in Israel or in France. And almost everyone who works with ayahuasca feels more intensely the need to save the planet.
Mm-hmm.
So it looks like the forces of wanting to save the planet are using or are psychedelics are one of those forces. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I know when I work with a group of people who've used psychedelics is they're much nicer to each other than a similar group of same professionals. Probably because they are not as caught by their egos, whatever it is, but the common bond is very strong. And the bond is also, let's make the world a place that we can all live in. And in a sense, the difficulties we're having, like fighting over a particular spending bill when the ice caps are melting,
exactly.
You know, it's like people quarreling over the hors d'oeuvres on the Titanic.
Right, as it's going down.
Right. So psychedelics are helping. The image that I keep in mind is Frodo carrying the Ring of Power into the land of Mordor, of darkness, of incredible kind of industrial slag.
Yes.
And he's not heroic. He's just this little guy who saw that someone has to do it. And there's a lot of little guys. And one of the things I love about the Students for Sensible Drug Policy is it's full of people that's saying, all we would like is something sane, something based on science, yes, ooh, science, not hysteria.
Yeah.
And they're saying, is that much to ask in a culture which worships science? And the answer is, it's not much to ask. And I think the Students for Sensible Drug Policy have had a major effect with marijuana, and I think they will have a major effect with psychedelics.
So as we're slowly passing the torch to the coming generations.
We're throwing the torch at you.
Throwing it.
We want you to just catch it and run, and it's going very well.
We hope so. We definitely hope so. And reflecting back on your experiences, a lot of us from this generation, we admire and respect the work that's been done, and yet we just can't even begin to conceptualize what it means to watch all of this work play out so positively at the end of your career. And not at the end of your career, don't get me wrong on that, but I mean, this has been 40 plus years.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
That's a lifetime of work and research to come to fruition.
Well, I used to talk about the years of government repression, but Charlie Grobe, one of the other wonderful researchers, called it a lull in research.
A lull.
And I thought, oh, how gentle. So the lull is ending, and there's a list that I'm an administrator on, and it's a graduate student list, and in order to get on it, you have to be a graduate student who has overtly done something in their institution about psychedelics. You've written a paper, you've done research, you want to do an advanced degree, something where you've, in a sense, come out. And it gets about 2 to 3 people every few days, and it has like 500 members, and they're from probably now 35, 40 countries. And I regularly open it, and it says, my name is, you know, Charlene Jawawa, and I'm from Liberia, and I'm in neuroscience, you know, in Italy, getting my graduate degree, and I've been working with such and such, and I'd like to do more psychedelic research. I think this would be a wonderful forum. So there's this group of incredibly talented people, many, many in very hard science, who are just desperately trying to find ways in which they can begin to do psychedelic research. Mm-hmm. So that's, and again, I look at the cultural waves, and that's a wonderful cultural wave.
That's happening, and we just need to, I think, find a way to get the mentors to the mentees to help facilitate this process, because from my experience as a UC Davis student, I found many closed doors when it came to pursuing any of these subjects. And you've mentioned that you've had experiences at Davis before, and I know that there are other students out there who have access to teachers and professors who may be interested in supporting them, but they're not getting the support from the institution or their department, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, this is one of the problems about tenure is you never have to grow again. But one of the advantages of tenure is you can also take some risks. And when students say to me, well, how can I possibly do any psychedelic research in my institution? I say, well, check with the younger professors, because they may be among the 26 million.
Yeah.
and check with the younger professors in the medical school. And very often I get back, oh,
thank you.
I found one, and he says, yeah, I can do this work. We just have to make it basically twice as good as another project, and most, and you'll have to work twice as hard.
No
and
problem.
Most of the students say, you know, that's my great pleasure. So institutions have an interest in surviving. And they have two theories. One is don't ever change anything because it's art, it worked. And the other is that will kill you. And that you better start changing on a daily basis. And so those are the two forces in an institution. I've taught, I guess, at Stanford, at Brandeis, at San Francisco State. And in each of them, I was their kind of freak. But I was very tolerated.
Mm-hmm.
Because I would say, do you believe in academic freedom or not? And all academicians have to say they believe in academic freedom when they clearly do not. But it allows you, again, to get a start.
Sure.
So that the institutions... I used to walk around Stanford and say, wouldn't it be great if this were an educational institution? Because look at all the facilities.
Oh, my God.
And, you know, Davis is a splendid place for education. And all the students want it.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to let the faculty know what you want. And that if they're open to a little of it, then you help them. And friends of mine at Santa Cruz went to the dean and said, we are so tired of people in the psychology department knowing nothing about neuroscience, and so tired of people in the neuroscience department knowing nothing about psychology, we... undergraduates want to offer a course.
Well said.
And the dean said, what would you offer? Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. The dean said, it'll have to be called such and such. And they said, why would it have to be called that? It's not a great title. She said, because if it's called that, it takes one signature, mine.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
So the Brain Mind Consciousness Club offered a course. In, as you know, catalogs online, sign-ups online, it filled in 30 minutes. And I went and looked at their midterm, because after all, I'm this, you know, super hip guy with all these years of consciousness research. And I thought, I said, I would get about a 20 on this test. This is so hard.
Fantastic.
It's unbelievable. And they said, we want to make it as hard as possible, because we want to prove something.
Yeah.
And then they said, most of our students got 90%. And I thought, because I actually taught near the end where, you know, you get courses, or you get a lecture or two where you don't have to know it for the final. So I was invited to do that.
They were going to test on your material.
So I wasn't, since I wasn't up to the level of neuroscience. But again, and the course now has been new undergraduate faculty. I think this is the third year with new undergraduates teaching the course.
That's fantastic.
So there's an institution where the institution hasn't changed much, but that little hole is now, you know, the school actually got, someone gave them some money so they can hire faculty to teach in their course.
That's incredible.
So institutions are this opportunity place, and one shouldn't ever look at the whole institution, because the whole institution is kind of, you know, kind of like a great big lumbering beast. But in between, there are little places, and that's where you know, you find there's a saying which is, cut where the holes are.
That's brilliant.
And it's from an old Chinese story about a chef who never sharpened his knives. And the king comes to observe him and says, how come? And the chef says, you know, amateurs need to sharpen their knives every couple of days when they're learning. And good chefs sharpen their knives every few weeks. And master chefs sharpen their knives every few years. I never sharpen my knives because I only cut where the holes are. And so that's the kind of model. And again, I've taught in a number of institutions, and there are always holes in an institution.
That's a good sign. We actually just got an email.
Through our psychology listserv, the psychology department is telling us how recently they put on a program through the computer science program for student-led and peer-taught courses. So I just... sent an email immediately to that discussing how we can start getting harm reduction courses and drug safety courses taught at UC Davis. And we've been approached to teach a curriculum within the high school And so we want to expand that.
Sure, into the college where it's much more necessary.
Yeah. And so that's one of our major projects that we're focusing on coming into the fall, is we want to offer some sort of certificate program where students can learn, like, what does it look like when someone's overdosing on this drug? What does it look like if someone's been, like, slipped a roofie? What does it look like if someone has alcohol poisoning? And how to empower students to be aware, be smart about it, and have the tools to be safe.
What's wonderful is when you do that, and you then, since it may be then, you make that curriculum available to the other chapters,
mm-hmm.
and they can approach their institution and say, well, Davis is doing it.
Yeah.
And universities are also very good at doing things second.
Yes.
Right? Because they say, well, if Davis is doing it, and Davis is kind of a square place, it's not the hippest university in California.
That's true.
How bad could it be? So that's actually a wonderful, how nice, it's exactly what I'm talking about. And you're saying, oh yeah, we're doing that.
There's a great need for it. We have friends who work within the Davis Unified School District, and in this year alone, there was 11 heroin overdoses at the high school level. So there's a big need for people to be more educated about drugs. We live in a world where we have them, and the best we can do is at least prepare people for it and give them the information to make smart choices and safe choices.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me tell you a story, because as you know, there's another group out there called DARE, D-A-R-E, that hits the grammar schools and junior highs. And I'll just tell you my favorite DARE story, because I met a guy who was taken endless amounts of different psychedelics in his lifetime. And we were talking, and he said, you know, I got started. He said, I was really interested in these drugs, but I was afraid to take anything. And then this cop comes to our school with a DARE program, and he has this board, and on the board are what each drug is and what it looks like and what color it is and what size the pills come in or the capsules. And I really learned a lot from it. So I immediately went out and started taking drugs. And I believe there is actual research that shows that a school that has had the DARE program will have an increase in drug use.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's like the most wrong-directed drug education. And I guess you're saying both of you took it, and here you are. So it didn't work very well for you.
Definitely.
Or it worked very well for you, like my friend.
Well. Yes, yes. We definitely became very open-minded after that.
Yeah, and I think, as you mentioned earlier, the approach that we really need to take is similar to the way we need to do sex education. We're not going to stop students from having sex. We're not going to stop students from having drugs.
Right.
Like, all across the board, like, that's not going to happen. So the best we can do is prepare people and educate people.
Right. Those of us who are dealing with universities, we think education works. Otherwise, we wouldn't be there. And so the other is that more information is better than less.
Definitely.
And that accurate information, repeated enough times, is remembered. So we're all really, again, I'm thrilled with what you're doing at Davis, and I'm thrilled with what's happening at CIS, where there's the first program which actively says psychedelics are a field of study,
mm-hmm.
because, again, it is cross-disciplinary.
Absolutely. And as we're moving forward, even this new legislation that was just coming out about the right or aid to death.
Assisted suicide, right. That people have a right to die.
How they want to, right. So, I mean, there's whole other industries opening up in terms of that. I mean, we can have potentially psychedelic therapy-assisted, you know, sessions dealing with end-of-life anxiety. And
well, let me tell you something that's quite amazing. It's just new. Dorothy and I just came back from Montana, a little vacation with friends, and Dorothy is sitting on the plane with a nice woman. I'm across the aisle. And she says to me, this woman works in hospice.
Mm.
And she says, they use medical marijuana.
Yeah.
And the woman says, you know, since we started using medical marijuana, nobody's afraid to die.
Oh, my gosh.
And incredible. I thought, oh, my gosh. Isn't that amazing? And I thought, I've never heard of anyone. I've never heard of hospice using medical marijuana. And I've never heard of people saying that. So my little researchy self says, where's that woman?
I know. Did you get her contact?
No, Dorothy just told me about it later. But what it says is, now that I've thought about it, of course, wouldn't I like to have people feel better about dying?
Absolutely.
And I want to use the minimum amount of drugs that lower consciousness, the barbiturates, etc.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And we know that marijuana, again, in states that have medical marijuana, painkiller drug use goes down.
Mm-hmm.
prescription numbers go down, people dying of overdoses, not in high school from heroin, but in the middle of their lives from their physician,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
go down.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something, again, inherently healing in what we're doing, and we're doing not only drug education, we're also doing drug replacement education.
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't touched the issues around antidepressants and antipsychotics and so forth, but since we're coming to the end of our
mm-hmm.
our time on media here, I will just mention that a number of the microdose people who are on various pharmaceuticals found that it was easier for them to taper off the pharmaceuticals if they were supported by a microdose.
That makes perfect sense.
So that opens up a whole interesting area, because some amazing number of percentage of people in the United States are on a pharmaceutical which has a side effect, which is they're addicting.
Mm-hmm.
And if you talk to people in the addiction world and you say that, they glaze over. Like, we don't even want to look at that, because the government money is really very good in addiction, but none of it is going for pharmaceutical addiction.
Absolutely.
So it may be that marijuana for pain control and that microdosing for anxiety control may be what we're looking towards.
That's amazing. So. That gives us lots of wonderful stuff to consider in the future. We have plenty of decades left of work for ourselves, and definitely for you as well.
Thank you.
So thank you so much. Do you have any other questions you want to follow up with?
One of the things I was interested in, just as we're talking about the timeline for legalization for therapeutic uses and for psilocybin, I know currently ketamine is being used for off-label treatment of depression in an outpatient clinic at UC San Diego. So I'm wondering if we'll see uses of psilocybin in that way as an off-label use for us before it's...
That's interesting.
Well, what I've suggested and what I see in the research is, if you're doing research with a socially controversial drug, you want to find initial uses where the medical profession likes to have you.
Mm-hmm.
And people who are very anxious before dying, nobody likes them.
Mm-hmm.
Their family feels terrible, and it's bad enough you're losing your mother, but she's making your life horrible for everyone else. The medical staff doesn't like them, and they can't say that, but they don't like them.
Mm-hmm.
Chronic pain patients,
mm-hmm.
similar.
Mm-hmm.
They're just not liked. So psychedelic people come in and say, we'd like some of your patients that you don't like.
Mm-hmm.
And when we bring them back to you, they're very cheerful. They say, I'm dying, but today is pretty beautiful, and I'm certainly glad I have a few months left. And instead of being racked by anxiety, this weekend I'm planting a summer garden with my granddaughter. I don't know if I'll ever see it, but she will. Very different. So that keeps the medical profession very happy. When we begin to take on major issues, then the medical and pharmaceutical community may for the first time be concerned that we're really cutting into a very major business model. But for now, the nice thing is we don't have to really worry about that. How fast will legislation come? Too slow.
Yeah.
Will it be the right legislation? Not at first. But there's a lovely saying, which is, a bad peace is still better than a good war.
Mm-hmm.
And inadequate, inferior, incompetent, partial legislation is so much better than, I don't care what the science says, it's bad. So anything that has some data behind it is going to be an improvement, and it will snowball, because as people find that what they knew all along was true, that these substances are safe if you know what you're doing, we're fine. I mean, if you know what you're doing, there are radioactive chemicals which in very small doses are really good for you. But people who work with them are very highly trained, and they're very highly trained to do things carefully. And that's, again, another version of the same model.
Mm-hmm.
So there are models in the culture about how to use things that are as complex as psychedelics, and it's a matter of applying those models. And I hope we will soon. and 9:20, this kind of day of psilocybin, we just have to keep in mind that we're dealing with a substance that's been used safely for thousands of years by perhaps at least a dozen cultures, and all that the research community and people like yourselves and the student community are saying is, why don't we pay attention to history, to science, to education, and use that as the basis for legislation? And I think we can all agree that not only we think that's true, but if you say to someone, well, wouldn't you like to use science and education to make your legislation, they're going to say yes until you tell them the topic.
That's pretty much what's happened. Well, I think we'll end it there. That's absolutely perfect. Thank you so much.
Yay! Thank you.